Okay. Okay, so Dima asked me to make a summary of some of the things which are known in the area of statistical physics concerning optimization problems, and especially random optimization problems. So I started by listing here a set of references, which are just some of the references, because the literature is quite huge, concerning these problems that I think that are quite relevant and can give you, well, an idea of how these ideas developed. The last one is a review article and is more or less has inside everything I'm going to tell you about. So if you're interested in a review, you can just go for this one. And the other ones are, well, relevant references where important features have been obtained and explained. So let me start by defining the random KSAT problem, which I'm not sure everybody knows, so I prefer to start from the basics and define it. This is the typical problem that people take as a representative of the NP class. And this is why most researchers focus on this one. There are small variants of it that sometimes make it a little bit easier to treat with analytical methods. We'll mention some of these later. But let me start by defining this one. So imagine that you have n Boolean variables. So we'll call them xi. They can take values true or false, each of them. And there are n of them that I label with the index I. Okay. So the ensemble of all these variables have 2 to the n possible configurations, and 2 possibilities for each variable, right? Now, we're going to choose a parameter, integer, k. And k, well, it will be an integer. I will take it to be either 2 or larger than 2. And the case is 2 and larger than 2 will belong to different classes concerning the difficulty to solve this problem that I'm going to define next. And k equals to 2 belongs to P, and k different from 2 belongs to NP. And this is has already been discussed in the 70s by these people here, and I can give you the precise references later if you wish, but the names of the places where these articles were published is very long, so I just give you the years, but then I can give you details if you wish. So I choose this parameter k, which is an integer. And it's fixed. Now, the construction of the problem to solve is made in the following way. So I will take k variables out of the set, this set over here, and I will construct a clause. This is the name that is used in the literature, which is going to be the OR between those variables that I pick. So imagine that I pick x1, x5, or I don't know, x7. And with the three literals, these are called literals of the clause, I will further ask them to be either true or false, with probability a half, either one or the other. So I will note like this, for example, say that with probability a half, I bar x1, and x1 bar means that to satisfy the clause, I need to set x1 equals false. With no bar over there, I need to set x5 equals true. And the last one means that I want to set x7 equals false. Okay. But the clause is satisfied if just one of them is satisfied. So I don't need to satisfy the three simultaneously. I need to satisfy one out of the three, and it's okay. If I satisfy two, it's okay as well, of course. But at least one. Okay. So now I go back and I put my variables again into the set, and I repeat the construction. So this was, say, clause number one. And I repeat the construction, and I construct another clause, number two, with the same procedure. And I repeat this procedure n times. And then I construct a formula.
Sorry, the clauses are always ors. There's never ands.
They're always ors. Within the clauses, there's always ors. But now come the ands. So the formula is the and over all the clauses. Okay? So I'm going to write it. I'm going to write it like this. CL. Or another notation that is a more typical notation that you will find in the literature is that for the ors, you do like this. And for the ands, you do like that. Okay. Okay. So the condition to satisfy the formula is that you have to satisfy all clauses. But to satisfy each of the clauses, well, it's enough to satisfy one literal within the clause. Now, this is the construction of what is called random k-sat problem. And I didn't say, or if I said it, I insist upon that. The k is the number of literals that there is in each clause. So in this example here, k is equal to 3. And I'm going to focus on the problem in which all the clauses have the same length, so they are all k in length. There are variations in which you can mix lengths, but okay, just don't take those for the moment. So it's random because each clause is constructed with this random procedure. And k, I said already. And sat, where does it come from? Well, it comes from the fact that it's easy to recognize that if n is very small and n is very large, you will satisfy this formula very easily. Well, if n is very large and n is very small, you will very easily find contradictions in the requirements that you ask from the variables, and then it will not be possible to satisfy the formula that you constructed. So the parameter, the control parameter in the problem, is the ratio between m and n. And say that I look at how the behavior of the formula, what is the typical behavior of these formulae for m and n fixed, and I trace an axis with the alpha such from 0 and increasing like this. Well, for each typical formula that I construct in this way, it's clear that if alpha is very small, the problem is satisfiable, while if alpha is very large, it is unsatisfiable. I will not be able to find a solution. And then for finite m and n, there will be some fuzzy region here where you will go from the satisfiable case to the unsatisfiable case. And what was observed, shown, determined in different ways is that if you take the limit of m or n going to infinity, m going to infinity and alpha fixed of this problem, there will be a phase transition at a sharp alpha c here that separates a phase which is satisfiable from a phase which is unsatisfiable. This alpha c depends on k. But it takes some value for each k. So now you can set the problem or the question. You can ask different questions. So you can ask the question of let me try to find a solution of the problem for a typical formula in the region of small alpha. Or I can try to say, well, let me try to find a configuration that minimizes the number of clauses which are not satisfied on the other side of the transition. I know that I cannot be able to satisfy all of them here, but there will be some configuration that has a minimum number of contradictions that makes, you know, the clauses not satisfied. So it's quite natural to think in terms of an energy function or a function, sorry, or a cost function. Cost function for this problem and other problems in optimization that will quantify how the formula is satisfied on this case or how they are unsatisfied on this other case. So this energy, one has to construct it, but one will construct it in such a way that it's zero on this side of the transition and it's different from zero on the other side of the transition. And the question that I just asked is to find the ground state everywhere. The ground state on this side will not have zero energy, and the other one it will. So from the optimization point of view, one can try to ask the question, where are the formula, the typical formula, or the how can I construct a formula that is difficult to solve on this side, or that is difficult to find its ground state on the other side? And these formulas, it's known that they are close to the phase transition. And as I was saying the other day in private conversations, it's also known that it's difficult to build those formulas. So if, you know, I tell you I want to work with alpha equals 2 alpha c minus epsilon, let's say, and, you know, build for me a formula which is very difficult to solve, then it's also difficult to do. But okay, let's forget about this problem for a moment. So here we'll talk about typical formula constructed in this with this procedure. Okay, as I said. So now, how does the mapping to a spin glass problem proceed? So the idea, of course, is to go from Boolean variables to binary variables, and to associate, say, true with the spin up, false with the spin down. And so the mapping is just to say that big psi, so I will do something like this. So let's say, well then, mapping the axis, I will just directly define the energy of the axis. And let's take the example that I wrote here. So for this clause, I will write an energy. And the energy will be such that in the energy, in this contribution to the energy associated at the clause number one, there are only three variables that contribute or that appear in it. So there will be three spins only that appear there, number one, five, and seven. Now, you see that if this requirement is equivalent to saying that I want S1 to be minus one, so if S1 is minus one, this is zero, and the energy is zero. If S1 is not minus 1, then I can also satisfy the clause by setting S5 to be equal to plus 1, and then this factor is 0. The same for the other. So there is a product here between these three factors, and there are only three variables that contribute to this energetic term. Now, the total energy will be the sum over all these energies. associated to each clause. And now you see that the randomness in the choice of the variables that appear in each clause appears in randomness in the interactions between the spins. Okay? So first of all, not all the spins are here, so there is some dilution in this term. And next, if you open up this product, you see that there will be one term which is a constant, the 1/2 to the power k. There will be terms which are linear in spins. There are terms which are two-body in spins. And there's also a term which is involving three spins. Okay? So putting all these ingredients together, one can construct an energy and write down a total energy that is equal to this expression. This, where this JL E is equal to zero if variable I does not belong to clause L. So if it doesn't appear, then there is no J associated to it. If it appears with the condition of making the variable true, then it's 1. And if it appears requiring it to be false, it's minus 1. So you can verify that with these choices, I'm reproducing the kind of formula for the energy that I was given here.
So the number of 1s and minus 1s, there's k of them?
No, k is the number of variables that appear in each clause. So k is always 3 in the examples I'm taking. Okay, so there can be 3 pluses if you require the 3 of them to be false, or they can be 2 and 1, 1 and 2. The number of minus signs is not fixed. Okay. So what is interesting about this energy is that there are at least terms that involve 3 spins, or k spins. The interactions, so this is why, sorry, we always talk about the p-spin model, because it's very similar to the p-spin model that we work with in the GLASI community. The difference, which indeed is not such a difference, is that these jij's can have zeros, because if the variables are not appearing, they are zeros. So it's a p-spin model defined on a dilute hypergraph. So one can draw this graph roughly, say that k is equal to 3. So each term that involves 3 spins is drawn with this kind of trident here. And then, since one variable, so the variables are here, are in the nodes. Since the variables can appear in several clauses, they will be linked with other trends. That, like this. Now my drawing, of course, is not very nice. Like that. Okay. So this hypergraph doesn't have a fixed connectivity in the sense that from each link, from each node, sorry, on the graph, not necessarily leave the same number of edges, so the connectivity is fluctuating. There can be loops. It's not tree-like. There can be closed loops like the ones I draw over here. Okay, it's dilute. What else can I say? It's not a normal graph because I have these units, which are these three things with three legs, but the objects that exist in math.
So what does a contradiction mean in this geometric language if you cannot satisfy your three set? So can you sort of visually see that?
No, but the loops are things that typically will make your life miserable. So when M increases, the connectivity of the graph increases as well, because you have more connections, because your variable will appear more times in the formulae. And then you will have more loops, and then you have the possibility of having contradictions within the loops, and then
so you are in that trap. So the graph doesn't tell you whether it's true or false?
No, because you see, the J's are on the links, and the signs of the J's will tell you whether there is frustration or not. So typically, frustration is linked to having interactions that own a closed loop. The product of them is minus one. Okay, then you can see that you cannot satisfy all the configurations of the spins. So if I don't tell you which are the values of the interactions here, the existence of a loop is not necessarily leading to frustration. It's not necessarily leading to the fact that you will not be able to solve your formula.
And the problem itself is to solve it in a specific realization,
right,
or just find alpha? What is the actual problem?
Finding alpha is relatively easy. It has been found for all k's, basically, for k equals two, analytically, k larger than two numerically, but with very good precision. What is difficult is giving a formulae to find a solution if the formulae is close to alpha c. Is there that the difficult instances are located?
Are they can be complete?
Yes. When k is larger or equal than three, this is the typical problem of the family of other NP-complete set of problems.
Well, what is the value of alpha? I mean, something order...
No, I mean, order 1 is 4.3 or something like that for the k equals 3, and it's 1 for k equals 2.
So it's not surprising, small, not surprising, large.
No. It's in the way in which things are normalized, alpha is order 1. So this is a good normalization of M and N.
Sorry to interrupt. Transition to NP completeness. So if alpha is very small, it's sort of trivial to satisfy, right?
Yeah.
So and then if you are close to alpha C, you're saying it's NP complete. So there must be a transition point where it becomes complicated.
Okay, I will talk about this. There's a lot which is known about that. I can give you some hints, some reasons why it's difficult to find solutions over here. It's linked to all what we know from the spin glass theory. And just give me 1 second and I'll add it. So how do we treat this problem from the statistical physics point of view? So here come these papers over there. Once it's set in these terms, it's a spin glass problem. On a dilute hypergraph, okay, but it's a spin glass problem. So then you have to look at the free energy density, search for phase transitions in the free energy density. The free energy density where? Well, you introduce a fictive temperature, let's say. The problem doesn't have a temperature to start with, but you can define a different function that depends on the quench randomness, which is here. But you can do that. And then from here, you define the free energy density, take the limit beta going to zero at a certain point to go and look for the ground states and see what happens. Now, from the statistical physics point of view, what is well established is how to take the average over this order, so average over all the possible realizations of formulae constructed in this way, the free energy density, and study this with replica techniques. Or it's also easy, or now more or less well established, to work at fixed J's and use these cavity methods. So they are methods which are well adapted to study this problem. The cavity is especially good for the dilute case, and this is why it has been so much used in later years. So I have already said that the problem, these people have already shown that k equals 2 is easy, so let's forget about k equals 2. K larger than 2 has a phase transition at an alpha, which is 0.2, I have it here. And why is it difficult? Well, the reason why it's difficult is because from the spin glass point of view, this sat phase is like the paramagnet, while this unsat phase is like the spin glass. However, for these B-spin models, we know already from the fully connected case, but it's also true for the dilute case, that here, or if I draw the phase diagram including temperature, now let me include 1 over alpha here, it's already known that above the critical temperature for the fully connected case, here there are many metastable states. And this, if I roughly draw lines like that, all these metastable states also exist for finite value of alpha. And they are structured in complicated ways. Very complicated ways, but they can be analyzed, those ways. So I just printed one plot here, just to say that this is different phase transitions that appear in the structure, in the way in which those metastable states organize in phase space for different values of alpha. Okay, so this is a zero temperature now. I only look at a function of alpha. This is what happens for a small, very small value of alpha, where there are many solutions to the problem, and it's very easy to find them, and it's very easy to go from one to the other one. It's like they are connected by single spin flips or a few spin flips. So there is a bunch of solutions, they are all together, and there's no structure in this sense. Next, there is a value of alpha where other clusters of solutions appear. But most of them are still in the big cluster that is the sum, let's say, of this one. Next, there is another one where this big one breaks, and now there are an exponentially large number of clusters with an exponentially large number of solutions within each of them. Then most of them disappear, there are still some, then all disappear, so this is the alpha C. But there are lots of a structure, let's say, of different kinds of organization of those solutions that already appear before alpha C. So on this part here.
Those are all sharp transitions happening, or this is just some steady progression?
No. There are sharp transitions that happen in certain quantities that you can go and look for. Like, for example, how many of these clusters there are, or how many solutions there are inside each of these clusters, and geometrical properties, let's say, of the organization of the solutions in the phase space. Mm-hmm. And this you can access with replica cavity kind of methods. Mm-hmm. So the thing is that it becomes difficult. I mean, from this plot, it's quite easy to see or to imagine that it becomes difficult to find solutions when they are, you know, hard to find phase space and they are far away and so on. So it's here that it becomes very difficult to find solutions. And one could do a similar analysis on the other side of the transition for the minimum energy state, but okay, forget about those. Let's focus on this side. So all this nice structure of solutions and so on, if you look at the k equals 2 case, it doesn't exist. It's simpler. So you don't have this bunching and these things. So now what happens, just this is summary of the classical thing, what happens with the quantum case? So in the quantum case, independently of optimization problems, this is the only part in which I've been involved, I had looked with some colleagues, just motivated by spin glasses again, the p-spin problem fully connected in presence of a transverse field. So now it's, you know, quantum spins. There is a transverse field over there. And what we found at the time was that the phase transition that is, you know, classical here, gamma going to zero, it goes up into the gamma different from zero axis. But what happens is that here, something strange happens, so the transition here becomes first order. And there is also a little leg that enters there into the paramagnetic phase, and that it separates what we call the classical paramagnet, because it's a paramagnet that is well connected to the classical one, from a quantum paramagnet that is more determined by the transverse field. So if the transverse field is in the x direction, this one is really in the x direction, well, this one is more like disordered everywhere. And this blue line is first order here and there. And the length of this blue line depends on the p. So it depends on the k, if you wish, here. But it's present for k larger than 3, larger or equal than 3. So, which is the same as saying that p is larger or equal than 3. So at the time, we did it for the fully connected case. And well, we had also the study of metastable states and so on and so forth with Giulio Biroli.
So that line is the line of first order phase transition, which ends with a second order phase transition point?
This last point over here?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So you can go from one to the other, do it like this, of course. But if you want to cross, you jump. Now, when times for quantum annealing discussions came, these people wrote a series of papers claiming that this first order phase transition is going to create a little bit of a problem for the use of those quantum annealing algorithms. Why? Because, well, I can try to draw this a little bit better. I try to do it here. If now I want to add this 1 over alpha axis, T gamma, it's difficult to draw something in 3D. Let's try to do it this way. I hope you understand what I mean by this. So what I mean by this is that there is a part here in this 3D spherical cascade that I'm trying to draw. There is a part here which is first order. So if you want to access what's going on here at zero temperature in this plane, zero temperature first and then gamma going to zero next, by some path that goes like that, you have to go to this first order piece. And this is the existence of this first order part survives to dilution. So it's, we did it first for the fully corrected case, but those people over there, and also in several works, these other authors of the review article, they also did it for the dilute case with the extensions of the cavity method to quantum systems. And this first order part is there. Okay. So there is no way to avoid going through it. And then you have to go through a first order phase transition if you want to access either the solutions close to alpha C or the minimum energy configurations on the spin glass side of the transition.
So what exactly is the quantum model? Does it sink in the transverse field?
Or? Right, yes. So the quantum model would be like saying that this is Z, let's say, and then you add this and you put hats. Well, I'm calling it.
Annealing means you're adiabatically changing gamma.
Right, this is the idea, no?
And why temperature and gamma? What's?
No, temperature is because temperature was already here in this plot, and I wanted to keep this plane, which was the one that was studied beforehand.
Okay,
this plane over here is just the plane over there in this other 3D phase diagram that I'm trying to draw.
The classical T equals zero problem.
Sure. This is why I said that what is really interesting is this other plane, which is the T equals zero one. But then I necessarily have to go through this first order part in any case. So
this transition at alpha critical, this is not a spin-Gauss transition, right? The spin-Gauss transition happens earlier.
It happens earlier. Depends on the problem. It depends a little bit on the problem. When I said that there were different colorations of these problems, you can, for example, change the fact that the connectivity was fluctuating into fixed connectivity. That makes the problem a little bit easier. It's not a KSAT problem. It's what is called a XOR-SAT problem for the optimization people. But it's still NP, complete. So the statistical physics people tend to work more with the one with the fixed connectivity because it's simpler for us. But it also has all the complexity of the NP completeness and so on. And then the positions of those transitions that I showed you, they change a little bit. And the where the RSB appears changes also a little bit. But the full picture remains the same.
So basically, usually spin-Gauss starts...
It depends on the problem, but it can start a little bit earlier. It can start here, in one of the alphas that I showed in the other picture. But in some of the problems, it starts here. So it depends on the problem a little bit. But the thing is that the all this complexity of solutions grouped together in metastable states and so on appears in the region where with the replica calculation, you would see it replica symmetric. But then when you go and do the cavity or tap approach, then you see that the replica symmetric solution that you have found is the mixture of many of those solutions that you access with different methods. So it's like a disguised paramagnet, a paramagnet, I would say. Not really a paramagnet. It's a paramagnet made of many structures within. So this is why I'm not talking so much about replica symmetry breaking, because it's kind of more fundamental to go and look at the structure of metastable states than to talk about replica symmetry breaking or not. Okay, and then final thing, I won't show it, but in these papers, and also in these papers and other papers by the same groups of people, the gap is computed in different ways. The gap between the quantum paramagnet and the spin glass, or the quantum paramagnet and those solutions that you want to get here, and it's exponentially small in n, so it's something that scales with some proportionality constant, but like 2 to the minus n. So this is...
So, sorry, are you arguing that annealing isn't useful in solving this KSAT problem?
I'm claiming that. I'm not the only one. I didn't write anything about this. I'm just reproducing, other people's papers and results. And what's the belief in my community is what you said, exactly.
Maybe you said it is false. So with this first order transition, you say it's therefore all values of alpha, is that the point? So we can't get around it?
No. For very, very small alpha, you will get here, and then it's very easy to solve the problem. But it's not here that the NP completeness is. The NP completeness is close to the transition.
Right.
It's there where the difficult instances are. But, here, you can solve the problem with any stupid algorithm. So there's a Boxart. I mean, there are many algorithms that solve these problems. I mean, it's very easy.
I was wondering, you could take a crazy path in the space of going to smaller alpha and coming back. I mean, we don't have to just go.
No, but it's difficult to move just straight, right? Because you don't want to change your program. you don't want to annul your question, right?
Why not? Probably
you still have to go. Once it becomes classy, right?
Even if you come through the classical path at a certain point, you have to come through here. And when you start trying to come through here, you will find all the structure that I showed you, and then you're dead for different reasons. You're classically dead. If you wanted to avoid this bunching of this part, the classical part of the difficulty, by coming vertically, let's say, then you find the first order phase transition, and you have a different problem, but a bad problem as well.
But actually, is it easy to find some state which is reasonably low energy, let's say, so could one?
Yes. That depends on the problem, but if you want to find a good approximation, let's say.
Good approximation. I don't want to.
Again, it depends on the problem. In these problems, you will not find such a very good approximation for the difficult instances. But for other problems with not such a structure, then it's very easy to find a good approximation. So, you know, again, for K2 SAT, it's very easy to find a very good approximation. Or for Sherrington Kilpatrick, it's very easy to find, to go very close to the ground state. Then, okay, if you want to find the actual ground state, you may have a little bit more trouble. But you will find it anyhow.
I see. And here, so how, let's say, so I have this problem, right?
Yeah.
I can, let's say I know that in the ground state I can satisfy some fraction of this clauses, right? Not all, but some fraction.
Yeah, those kind of questions define other problems in the complexity classification. So there are many of those problems that also people look at. The informaticians and mathematicians and so on. So, but I don't know the literature so well, so as to, you know, tell you much more about that. But yeah, there are many of those problems which are.
Because I guess practically, right? So what is the simplest example of a very difficult problem which falls into this class? Some practical problem, let's say, I don't know.
Yeah, but Trondheim-Sellmann is easier than this one. It's more similar to the k equals 2 than to k set. Yeah.
Does k equals 2 just mean you only have two?
Yes. K equals 2 means that you have only pairs of spins.
So you only have one frustrated loop?
You have one less thing.
But in terms of the hypergraph, how does it look?
Like a graph. So instead of having this trident, you will have a graph. So. No, because here the spins are there. There is no spin here.
Yeah.
And while in a graph you will have links. I don't know. You can also have loops.
But you're gonna have one loop, right? You can have multiple loops.
You can have loops.
Oh, because they can.
You can. Yeah.
Right. So you can still have satisfied loops, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
No, of course, I mean, if you know already the solution to the problem, you know which is the pinning field that you have to apply to take any configuration to the solution that corresponds to the particular Jij's interactions that you have here. It's like, I know, in a ferromagnet, it's very easy to put it in one of the two other states. You apply a field up or a field down, and you take it. Here, if you know what is the solution a priori, then you apply fields that, you know, take each of the spins in the direction that it should go, and then you will do it also very quickly. But of course, you have to know the solution a priori, so this is cheating. So of course, there will be one field that will take you quickly to the solution, but it's a field that you have to know a priori, and this is not the one that you want to use, because otherwise you have already solved the problem.
So the alleged D-Wave quantum computer, I think, tried to use quantum annealing to solve these very hard Ising spin glass problems. Do you think this research kind of casts doubt on its entire fundamental premise?
Well, it seems like
a... Well, do they purport to solve K-stat somehow? Or is that what they're trying to do?
K-stat.
I mean, the point is whether or not you go through a phase transition, whether or not the gap closes in terms of whether or not quantum annealing is useful for these types of problems. So
it's known that there's exponentially small gaps for the problems that they do.
Yeah.
It's not the same question as is it useful? Because just because you don't get an exponential speed up doesn't mean you get no speed up.
No, of course. I mean, you can maybe get a speed up. On the prefactor, on, I don't know.
So there's no good understanding of the cases when you should get the speed up and what kinds of.
No, I don't think so. I don't think there is a good understanding. Yeah, I don't think there is a good understanding of that. No.
So it's just essentially a hope.
Yeah. And of course, there were some simulations.
In general, I'm saying. Right? Well, like
There's that, and then they're also on a very restricted graph, right?
So, right, exactly.
There's some question as to sort of the hardness of the instances on this like 2D graph that they do, and so on.
So also,
yes.
Just want to go back to my previous question. So is the computational complexity is a direct function of this alpha? For example, 4.1, is it NP or it's not NP? Like 4.0, is there a transition in terms of computational complexity near alpha? It's just sometimes it's...
You could say it this way, yes. In terms of my plot here, if you wish, the problem will start being these phase transitions that I'm showing here correspond to values of alpha where certain algorithms will stop being effective. So the complexity also depends on the algorithm, right? So, you know, for a certain algorithm, the algorithm will be able to solve the problem until some alpha, and then it will start failing typically. Then there will be smarter algorithms that will be able to solve the problem until another alpha, and then they will start failing.
Yeah, but then the algorithm will start failing typically or on average?
Well, typically or on average, more or less the same, no?
Yes. I'm not an expert, so NP completeness or not is a function of the algorithm, right? That's what you're saying.
No, I mean, it's, okay, let's say it this way. So for a given value of alpha, let's imagine that I just choose alpha here.
Yes.
Here there will be some formulae that will be easy to solve and some formulae that will be very difficult to solve.
Give me a specific realization of this J, right?
Exactly, exactly. So the easy ones will be solved by any algorithm, basically. You know, classical, quantum, whatever, they will be very easy to solve. The difficult ones, some algorithms will fail, some other algorithms will not, because they will be more intelligent.
But the difficult ones, they have this fixed probability, so that's what I was asking, basically.
Yes. It will be typically, but now I say, and now I'm talking about a particular formula, right? So I'm saying the formula is easy, then I solve it very, very easily. The formula is difficult, and then I try different algorithms on that formula. Some of them succeed, some of them don't succeed on this formula.
But there is finite number of such realizations, basically. It's not a vanishing number.
Exactly, of realizations of difficult formula, yes. And for example, I was telling Dima that in the computer scientists' conferences, there is a competition for bringing a difficult formula, and there is a competition for solving the difficult formula. So people come with their algorithms and try to solve the formulas proposed by other colleagues.
And this is what you also have for the D-Wave, right?
Yeah.
Like Google's most recent paper was proposing a class of instances that's very hard for classical annealing and very easy for the D-Wave. There's another classical algorithm, which is you just look at them and you see what the solution is, but they're sort of engineered to be really hard for classical annealing. So that in the D-Wave community, there's this exact same competition that somebody comes up with a new class of instances and then somebody comes up with a new algorithm.
Right. And the ENP thing, it would say that for this k equals 3 such problem, there are some very difficult formulae that you will not be able to solve with an algorithm that doesn't scale exponentially with a number of variables in your formula.
For any alpha?
No, for particular alphas, because for alpha equals 0.
Oh, let's say 0 to 10 to minus
5. Oh, for any, okay. If you want to say for any.
For any non-zero alpha, there is.
For any non-zero alpha, there exists some formula that is so difficult that you're not able to solve it with a non-exponentially long algorithm. This is the statement. Yes.
Does anything interesting new happen at k equals 4, or is it just qualitatively similar?
It's the same, it's similar. And with mixtures of k equals 3, 4, and so on, they will find the same thing.
So, but maybe we can start a bit and then we can continue tomorrow because we also have a sort of general discussion at 11 tomorrow. So why don't we start? I don't know, how much time do you need, Mark?
I don't know.
But perhaps let's start now for a bit, and then we can do tomorrow. Yeah.
Can do a little bit.
Okay.
People can leave if they're tired.
So, I guess the idea was to say a bit, not coming from the statistical physics side, but maybe some of what the ideas from quantum theoretic quantum computation community is looking at. It's a little bit funny for me because it's not exactly an area that I'm working in. I consider this more of a sort of journal club style presentation. I just wanted to facilitate a discussion. So we talked with Dima and thought it would be interesting to have this discussion. And so it's a topic that I've been interested in a long time. And I did some literature search, and I can tell you what's sort of going on there. What I think are some of the interesting issues, and then hopefully we can just discuss. And maybe some of you even know bits of this better than I do, and we should just talk freely. It's not that I'm trying to lecture to anything. So I think one interesting question about this adiabatic quantum computation, which may or may not be familiar, is what's its relation to sort of usual quantum computation, right? So there's different models of quantum computation. And so there's the usual, quote, usual one, which is circuit model. And this is where we think about, okay, there's some qubits. So we have qubits here. And then apply some unitary gates on them. U1, U2, maybe all kinds of different operations that can happen, and then at the end, measure these qubits. Some measurement devices here. Okay, so
is it meter or?
Yeah, that's the meter, and they all read plus here. You get two different answers even there, right? Okay, so this is kind of the usual picture of quantum computation. It's most analogous to what a classical computer does, right? You have gates, AND gates, OR gates, etc. You can also have entangling gates here. Okay, so that's sort of one model of quantum computation. Then we also have this adiabatic computation, which looks very different. So here we have some kind of Hamiltonian, which is going to be a function of time, continuous function of time. And take some initial Hamiltonian here, some time t later it'll be a different one, and somehow we'll take a path through Hamiltonian space very slowly, going from this one to this one, and somehow this HP has a ground state which encodes the answer to the problem we're asking. So this basically, this HP is sort of it's the energy function that we just solved, this sort of spin glass problem, right? So it would be sum with some, say, J. Well, we could have many different terms in there in principle, sigma z, I, etc. So basically, somehow we want to, say, find the ground state of this Hamiltonian. We're going to get there by just starting from a simple Hamiltonian whose ground state we can prepare. For example, all sigma x's, just a nice product state, and then adiabatically go here. And it's not immediately obvious that the problems you can solve in this way
are the same as the ones that you can solve in this way, efficiently, right? It's a very different thing. So that's a question we would want to answer. And so it took some big collection of people several years ago to prove that these are actually equivalent in the sense of complexity. So complexity, you already heard about it, sort of a way of organizing or characterizing how difficult it is to solve problems. So there's sort of a picture. This is a conjecture. It's not totally known how these different problems all relate to each other. But there's some huge class of problems called P space, which basically are all the problems that could be solved in principle using a polynomial amount of memory or number of bits in them. Okay, so that's a lot of different problems. It doesn't say it's fast. It could be exponentially long time, but at least it can be solved in principle, right? So then inside of this are the NP problems, which are problems that aren't necessarily able to be solved quickly, but we can check the answer. So if you give me a proposed solution, I can tell you very quickly if it's right or wrong, but I can't necessarily find that thing fast. At least we don't know.
But let's say K salt is not, isn't NP, because let's say I give you a solution, how do you check that this is the lowest kind of check?
No, it's check whether it's zero or no zero.
Yeah.
If you go on the other side, then it becomes difficult.
Ah, then yeah. It's max case.
Exactly.
Right.
So this is one of the other questions that people also ask. So yes. There are many questions of this kind.
Yes, yeah. Zero, non-zero is easy, but yeah. To find what's the best if I can't satisfy it, that's hard.
That is hard.
Okay. Right.
You can always turn an optimization problem into a decision problem by asking, is there a state that has energy lower than -5? And
right.
that's an NP, and then if the answer is yes, you can ask, is there one that's lower than -6,
mm-hmm.
and so on. So optimization is the same as decision. So you can always map an optimization problem into a decision problem.
So it's still NP or something?
Mm-hmm. Right, so then there's some subclass of NP, which are the problems that are NP complete, which somehow if we can solve those, then we would know we can solve all of these. And then there's another region of this thing called P, which, you know, there's a large amount of money available if you can prove whether P is the same as this NP or not. But I think it's pretty much agreed on that it's most likely smaller. So these are the problems which can be solved in a polynomial amount of time. Okay, then this is about classical. Now, when you have a quantum computer, there's something else I have to draw here. I'm not sure exactly where to draw it, but you know, maybe it's something like this. And this thing is called BQP, which stands for bounded error quantum probabilistic, I guess. So these are problems which quantum computer solves in polynomial time with some number, some error rate, which is less than, say, a third or something. Just pick a number, right? So it's not going to always work, but with some probability, which is okay, it will work. And so this is this what a quantum computer can do. And then the question is, you know, we know it's bigger than what a classical computer can do. We have, say, Grover's search algorithm factoring. I guess we don't really know. We don't know if there's a classical algorithm. Is it known, actually? I mean, yeah, factoring is, Shor's algorithm is faster than the best known classical one, but I'm not sure it's known that there can't be a classical one.
I don't think it's known. Factoring, yeah, it's not NP complete, so there may well be an algorithm NP.
Right. Okay, so the sense of equivalence, you know, asking whether these are equal, basically is the set of problems that I can solve, you know, in polynomial time here, exactly the same as these. Or in other words, can I find some kind of one-to-one correspondence, suppose I have an algorithm here which solves a given problem. What is the, you know, what is the time-dependent Hamiltonian that would achieve the same thing? Or, you know, given some adiabatic algorithm, which is the circuit that would accomplish the same thing?
Just to make sure I understand the language. So, Grover is, I guess, classically polynomial, and also quantum mechanically it's a little bit better, but so...
Polynomial speed up, yeah.
Right, but that doesn't tell you that BQP is in principle bigger than... So Grover is not an example of BQP being larger than...
That's true, Grover. That's true. Okay. Yeah. So this, you know, this dashed circle being bigger here, that's a conjecture. We don't know.
Right.
That's right. Good. Right, so then this is kind of a two-way proof to show this. First is, suppose we have this, which circuit do we get? And then if we have this, you know, which kind of time-dependent Hamiltonian will implement it. The first one is kind of simple. The second one is a little bit interesting, the way it works. So I think that's why it's one reason why it's worthwhile just to see it. So if we want to go from adiabatic circuit, so basically we have some Hamiltonian, and there's an evolution. Which is just time-ordered exponential of this Hamiltonian. And then you can imagine just sort of trotterizing this thing, or just taking a bunch of small time steps. So this thing would be U of bunch of small unitaries, each one is approximately like this. And if this H is just a sum of few body terms, I can split this up into a product of little unitaries, which would be all the gates on such a step. Okay, so it's quite simple to get from this kind of evolution to a circuit. You just chop up time, and each small time step is a little unitary, which you can write as gates. Okay, so that direction is fairly simple. The other one, it's kind of a neat trick that's used. So suppose we have this circuit. Maybe I can just use the same one. Have a circuit, and then at each stage of the computation, there's a state of the system, right? So here's psi 0. After this first gate, I have psi 1, and some psi 2, and then I'm done. In this case, so the trick is actually to add some auxiliary qubits here with a clock. So a clock register, which just has a value 0, 1, 2 at each step. Basically the point is, you know, this adiabatic computation is about ground state finding. So I want to somehow turn this into some kind of ground state finding. So I'm going to find a Hamiltonian whose ground state actually encodes the entire history of this computation in it. And the way to do it is to make a Hamiltonian which is sort of a sum over t, which is this time step. Okay, so this is basically it's kind of nearest neighbor hopping of this clock. And each time I take a step forward, I apply this unitary. And because the Hamiltonian has to be Hermitian, I have to, you know, add Hermitian conjugate. So this is a perfectly fine Hamiltonian. Now, to get it exactly the way that's desired, there should be some slight changes on the boundary, but let's just ignore that for the moment. Right, so basically the ground state So if we just have not this u here, right? Nearest neighbor hopping, the ground state, on a minus, right? The ground state would be a plane wave with k equals 0. So it would be uniform superposition over all times. And once I've put this u here, it'll become a uniform superposition of the clock register of time 0, 1, 2, 3, and the state, psi 0, psi 1, psi 2. And so if I would measure at the end the clock register, and I get the result, t final, then I know in the data register I'll have the answer to the computation. So basically, you know, I'll have an algorithm where I end up with the ground state of this thing, then I may have to measure it a few times, repeat this a few times until I find the right final time here, and I'll get the answer. So the point is, this will become my H problem, then I just find some trivial H0 and adiabatically sweep from that one into this one. Now I've transformed this circuit into an adiabatic algorithm.
And you're guaranteed that gaps will not become smaller.
Yeah, so there's some proof of that. I can't reproduce it now, but that's where the hard work was in this. So this clock thing is a trick introduced by Feynman originally. And Kitaev modified it a bit. And then these people, I forgot to put the reference. This is from Dorit Aronov and several others. So basically in this paper, they worked out this whole thing and showed that the gap actually won't close if you do this. Okay, so that's the way sort of this proof goes, showing equivalence between these two. So at least in principle, this adiabatic quantum computation is just as powerful as usual one. So any problem that one can solve, so can the other one. The trick is that, not trick, but issue is that this adiabatic quantum computation is most often discussed in the context of optimization problems, like we just heard about, which are very difficult, and in particular, you know, different instances can be harder or easier, and it makes the analysis quite hard. As we heard, basically, it looks like there's no hope that because of this, you know, first-order transition, that you'll actually solve these k-sat problems quickly, meaning there's not going to be any exponential speed-up from it. But that doesn't imply that the quantum algorithm isn't better than the best classical one. So that's something that's not known. So you could still have some polynomial speed-up by using a quantum annealer relative to the best classical algorithm. It's an open question. So basically the power of this adiabatic annealing, quantum annealing, is just not well characterized for optimization problems because they're so tricky. So many different instances. It's a wide open field. So there's many things to be discussed there. Now, one particular thing that... I called a friend yesterday who's... I used my lifeline, phone a friend, who is an expert in this field, to ask him, so what are sort of the issues out there right now? And one that he said that was quite interesting to me was that most of the experiments, meaning D-Wave, and theory also about this adiabatic quantum computation is restricted in that the types of Hamiltonians considered are what's called stochastic. It's a funny word. And what it means is that all off-diagonal elements are real and positive. Negative, sorry. Non-positive. And actually, such Hamiltonians are kind of simple in the sense that the ground state of such a Hamiltonian is real and has no nodes. And it can be positive, basically. So examples of such a Hamiltonian would be nearest neighbor hopping. That's kind of a boring one. A ferromagnet has this property. You know, the ground state of a ferromagnet is very simple. There's no frustration, not even any quantum fluctuations. Also, a transverse fieldizing model has this property. So there's many systems which have this property. But the thing is, since the ground state is so simple, it's just a positive function, to some extent you can think of it, so if I would think, here's some, say a wave function on a bunch of sites, right? If it's always positive, it looks pretty much like a classical probability distribution in some sense. You know, it's normalized slightly differently, but more or less it's like a classical probability distribution. And the interesting thing about quantum mechanics is interference. If we want to get some quantum speed up, something better interfere. Otherwise, how is it different from classical? So there's some thought that, you know, if you're really doing this adiabatic quantum annealing using Hamiltonians where ground states are essentially classical, you know, maybe we're missing some of the power. Okay, so that's one side of the coin. There have been attempts to try to prove that there are classical algorithms that simulate it, and they've all failed. But this is an open and I think very interesting question. So what does it take to get some speed up? This looks kind of like something that's probably not very good. So looking for algorithms, not using stochastic Hamiltonians may be beneficial.
So what is a good non-stochastic Hamiltonian?
Well, if you just had, spin glass with positive and negative couplings, it'll be there already.
Can you prove that's not stochastic?
Well, you just have to write it down, because it's a very simple condition to analyze. You just write it down as a stochastic matrix and see if there's a minus sign somewhere.
Yeah, but you can...
Plus,
it's a diagonal.
Yeah, it's a basis-dependent notion.
Ah, sorry, that's diagonal. Yeah, that wasn't a good example.
But somehow spin glass should be higher direction, so it shouldn't fall into this class.
No.
Well, okay.
Using spin glass is stochastic, but like an XY spin glass on a... Like replace the Ising couplings by XY couplings. Now, that may not be a useful computational Hamiltonian, but that on a non-bipartite graph will be non-stochastic. Mm-hmm.
So you want
the... Anything that has a sign problem.
Sign problem.
Yeah, I think it's exactly sign problem.
Yeah, it's quantum information speak for sign problem.
Yeah, that's right.
But that's the point, is how do you prove that a given Hamiltonian has a sign problem?
It is basis dependent, right?
Yeah.
You can't.
Yeah. So you don't know what that class of stochastic Hamiltonians is.
Right, so the definition of this thing, so there was a paper by Bravi, I have the reference here, I'm not going to write the whole thing, where this thing was defined. And there were, because obviously it is a basis dependent statement, I was wondering. And so they define it in the standard basis, which is basically...
Yeah, but that...
I know. It's...
I'm trying to find a nice word for useless.
For what?
I think Matthew has another... what is it? Like a finite depth... You can change base... If you can get rid of the sign of the finite depth of unitaries.
Yeah.
That's probably...
You know, it depends where... if you just have some Hamiltonian, you want to ask, could you... put it into this form, that's not so easy. If you're thinking from a computational point of view and you're encoding problems where your Hamiltonian, I mean, you're always writing it starting in this, well, no, it doesn't help actually. Okay, it's a one direction thing. If you start in this computational basis and you see that you have only non-positive off-diagonals, then you know that you're in this class. Now, if you don't have it, maybe you could rotate and get rid of them. But at least it's one basis where if you happen to see it, you know you're okay.
But let's see, so how does it help actually? So the statement is that if you have
So you know if you're non-stochastic. No, sorry, you know if you're stochastic, for sure. As you're saying.
Yeah.
Sure.
And then once you know it, how does it help? So does it make somehow adiabatic?
It helps by telling you your adiabatic quantum. It helps by telling you that this is potentially useless.
No, I wouldn't say useless. I'm just saying it's a restrictive class, yeah. Right? So most of the work that was done and most of the theory and also experiments are done for cases where we're not using the most general possible Hamiltonian. We're sticking to ones which have this no sign problem, basically. Now, maybe Hamiltonians with a sign problem are more powerful than the ones that aren't.
I mean,
so there's a class of.
But you don't know what they are.
I don't know what it is.
Well, you don't know. It's like you can't prove that you're non-stochastic.
Right, but you
think stochastic is one basis.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, sorry. I think I got non.
So you can diagonalize anything. Yeah.
But I think this came up sort of in the whole D-wave discussion, because what happens for the D-wave is you can run quantum Monte Carlo on the same instances, and you get something that looks pretty similar to what the D-wave spits out. So the obvious idea for the D-wave people is to, it's come up with a system that the quantum Monte Carlo guys can't simulate without thinking really hard. And that's where the stochastic, non-stochastic thing comes in, I think.
Yeah, I think it's another example that's sort of back and forth. Let's find some problem that one can do, then we find a new classical algorithm, then find a new instance, and find a new classical algorithm. So this just keeps going. I don't exactly know where that is, where that's leading. We can do this forever. It'd be nice to have some more general statement.
And what you can do is you can maybe make interesting statements about Hamiltonians that are stochastic, even in like the local computational basis. Like, there's these statements that there are at least polynomial speedups of quantum Monte Carlo over classical Monte Carlo for stochastic Hamiltonians.
And this is general, or is it?
No, there's particular. So people have found particular instances where classical Monte Carlo gets stuck and quantum Monte Carlo does not get stuck. So that doesn't necessarily. I mean, those aren't necessarily hard instances, but you can tailor them so that sort of specific algorithms get stuck and specific quantum algorithms don't. Whether that's useful or not is a whole other question.
Stuck, you mean in like an ergodicity sense? Like stuck?
Yeah.
Right. Quantum Monte Carlo is a classical algorithm, so.
Yeah.
So that doesn't necessarily mean a real quantum computer would. I mean, it's just saying one classical algorithm is better than another classical algorithm.
Oh. Actually, maybe in this case you need quantum annealing even, and not just quantum Monte Carlo.
Yeah. Okay, so there's one last thing. I don't know if I can take a vote or something, which is related to something that Dima asked earlier, was what if you don't want to get the ground state, but are interested in some staying close to it. So if you'd be happy just to get some low energy state. So I don't know if I should say it or okay. I can just tell you quickly what that's about. So this adiabatic quantum computation kind of initially came from MIT group, Farhi and others, and so recently.
Actually, it came from somebody in Japan.
Oh, really? Do we know the name?
Nishimori.
Nishimori. Okay, good. Thank you.
It was a few years ago.
Yes.
Okay, good.
Somebody from spin glass community, by the way.
I see.
He was using it for SK. For the trending with flat rate model.
I see. Okay, good to know.
Good to know.
Yeah, exactly. So, after all this negativity that, this thing isn't so useful, at least it's not going to solve NP-complete problems. More recently, they came up with an algorithm for finding approximate solutions. And I guess Farhi's going to be here in a week or something, so maybe he'll even tell us about it.
He'll be there next week.
So there's some approximate, what is it called? Quantum. Approximate optimization algorithm. Right, so it's basically not finding the ground state, but just try to stay low on the spectrum. Okay, and it's fairly simple. So there's some cost function, and z is basically a bit string. So just encoding binary values of all the variables. exactly of the type we've been discussing, and we want to find a Z where C is close to maximal. You can make it a minimum if you put a minus in front of it or something, it doesn't matter. Right, so there's a Hamiltonian which implements this cost function, which is basically just like that, but I could also decompose it into a sum of clauses, which are just few body terms, a bunch of them. And if I would evolve a system with this sort of cost Hamiltonian, I'll get a unitary, and this gamma is some kind of angle, which is basically the time that I leave it on for. And then there's sort of the transverse field term. So I get a very, very similar flavor. So essentially what I'm going to do is, instead of adiabatically sweeping from this to that, I'm just going to apply either this or that and do it kind of stroboscopically, one and the other. So then I'll have a U of some other angle, beta. These are some free parameters that I have. And I'm going to take P steps. So P is some other integer number that I pick beforehand, which is how many times I'm going to allow myself to apply these two operations. And then I'll find a state which is sort of this U naught Okay, so I'm allowed to actually pick different values of this gamma and beta each step. So I just apply cost function, transverse field, cost function, transverse field, and do those pairs p times. And I apply this thing to initial state, which is a symmetric superposition over all 2 to the n values. Which is essentially just the state where all the spins point to 1x. So there's a quantity f, which is the expectation value of the cost function after this given number of steps. And since these gammas and betas are free parameters, I want to optimize over them. My goal was to find the maximum value of this cost function, right? So this max beta call it M, and what they showed was that a limit, if you take a limit p going to infinity of this mp is equal to max of this thing. So if you allow yourself to take infinitely many steps, then you would find essentially the optimum value. If you pick a fixed p, then you'll get some approximation to it. And actually, they also showed that this thing kind of converges, monotonically. So as you make p bigger and bigger, you just get closer and closer to the best answer. And the fact that this works isn't so surprising, and it's quite similar to this. As I said, this is even kind of a special case of it, because if you would alternate very quickly between this basically problem Hamiltonian and this one, you know, you could spend more time on this one and slowly spend more and more time on that one and essentially take a smooth path between here, but this is a slightly more general way of doing it. So then, you know, this question of how good is this? Is this better than classical? I think this is being discussed.
So in the case of the quantum circuit model, of course, it's obvious how to do the error correction. Yeah, about the quantum computing, maybe not so clear, but is this sort of a way of rewriting this adiabatic quantum computing that it looks like a circuit model, and you can actually do error correction on this thing here?
So that's a good question.
Allow one to do then quantum error correction for all of these things here, which otherwise is not so obvious?
That's a good question. I wouldn't say it's exactly just rewriting this. Because in general, the optimal values that you find here won't be small in the sense that you'll apply one Hamiltonian for some time and then a totally different one for another time. It's kind of like bang-bang control. I don't know if you guys know what this bang-bang control, but there's certain types of optimization problems where you have a control parameter, and you might think that you want to sort of smoothly change it as a function of time to get from A to B. But the best thing to do is actually just apply the extreme values. Apply nothing for some time and apply maximum. So very often, if some conditions are satisfied, that's the best thing to do. And this is kind of an example of that. Instead of continuously changing the Hamiltonians, is just apply full problem Hamiltonian, full transverse field, and alternate that way. So that's why, I mean, it's slightly different from this. Now, it may be that error correction may be easier here. I don't.
But is it not that if you take very many steps over here, that it sort of approaches what you're doing over there? And only if you have a very small number, I mean, if the number of your variation parameters is very small, then you sort of maybe you do something that looks different.
So it's a good question. It's not necessarily the case. So you could take many steps. Now here, there are different paths you can, in principle, take. Does it allow myself to take a million steps? Will the optimal values of these gamma and beta be that I just kind of smoothly go here, or will it actually just have me doing something kind of crazy? I don't know. Actually, finding the optimal values is a very hard problem. Right? That's the non-trivial part of this. This is easy to write down, but then we actually need to find the best gamma and beta.
But in both cases, there exists a unitary evolution operator for the entire sort of evolution. So it's just some commutators of this, transverse field and the interactions. Mm-hmm. So, and you can just use, Baker-Hausdorff relations, I guess, here to combine it into one single exponential. So I guess the equivalence can be proven if you can prove that you can basically construct any unitary evolution operators on both sides with the commutators, right? So, I mean, if you have an infinite number or very large number of these, unitary operators, yeah, you can just commute them, combine it to, some big exponential. And presumably you can get the same thing you would get on this side.
Right. So I think the usefulness of this, so it's clear that you can get this from this. I think what's useful is that here, actually, the goal is to try to get a good approximation to the solution, not trying to actually find the ground state. And then it's possible to prove, say, as you make p bigger and bigger, so not talking about infinite p, but some reasonable number, that we get better and better answers the larger we take p, if we keep optimizing at each step. And that's sort of the non-trivial part of this. So if we take p to infinity, then I think we all agree that we can just, mimic this evolution, or as you say, just look at this unitary and make this out of that. But the question is, if I just want to have a limited number of steps, what can I do with it? And that's what this thing is about.
And is there a unique solution in terms of, this vector of gamma and vector of, collection of these gammas and betas for this optimization? Is it proven that it just exists one unique set of gammas and betas, or there isn't?
So, whether the solution is unique, I'm not sure.
So the goal here is to find maximum of the COZ, right? That's the problem, right? You're trying to solve.
Yeah, right. The The thing you're trying to find a z, yeah, such that we have c of z, which is close to the maximal possible value.
Right, and then you somehow rewrite this problem into an optimization problem for these gammas and betas, right?
Yeah.
So the question is it, you know, one-to-one correspondence, is there a unique solution for these gammas and betas, or?
I don't know. We can look in the paper. I don't know. So they find a solution for gamma. If you want to solve a certain problem, you find gammas and betas, and then run it. Now, whether it's unique, I guess probably yes, but I don't know. We can look.
Is it known how the error falls off as a function of p for the optimal? Is it like how quickly?
Probably depends on the problem. Right. This said almost nothing about what kind of problem we're solving here, and pretty certain that it will depend on which problem you want to solve.
Will they prove it generally?
They prove, I mean, they discussed this algorithm, and then they initially proved for some specific kind of problem, you know, what gammas and betas to take, and then they have further papers on different problems, and then there was some result that initially they actually had speed up over the best classical algorithm, and then a lot of high-powered computer scientists got together to try to prove them wrong and made a new classical algorithm that was faster, and it's back into this cycle again.